At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today, an answer to one lasting question about the financial crisis. As the banks were doing everything that they were doing, where were the accountants? Well, not paying attention, perhaps, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 20th of December today. New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has about 10 days left on the job. He'll be sworn in as governor on New Year's Day. But he's not just biding his time on the way out. There are reports today that Cuomo is going to file civil fraud charges against the big accounting firm Ernst & Young. The case is said to center around some creative accounting at Lehman Brothers as the financial crisis was gathering steam, and whether Lehman's auditors, the aforementioned Ernst & Young, picked a convenient time to look the other way. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
This will be the first time a big accounting firm is charged for its actions related to the financial crisis. Robert Mintz is a former federal prosecutor and a white-collar attorney. He says the key to this case is going to be whether investors were misled by Ernst & Young's audits.
An attorney general is going to look at this case and decide whether investors may have made decisions about what to do with their money based upon some assurance that they got from outside auditors.
This case calls to mind what happened to Arthur Andersen after the Enron scandal. That lawsuit was eventually thrown out, but not before the accounting firm went out of business. Mintz says that probably won't happen to Ernst & Young, especially since it's a civil case, not a criminal one. Howard Schillett is an expert on forensic accounting. He says the case is important because it highlights the job of the outside auditors.
The prosecutors have a moral responsibility to be sure that investors in any company can feel confident that the financial reports are produced without financial trickery. So this is really not about Lehman. It's about protecting investors today.
If it's found guilty, Ernst & Young could face very big fines and potentially lawsuits from other investors. News of the impending suit is being reported by the Wall Street Journal. Neither the Attorney General's office nor Ernst & Young had returned calls by airtime. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Back about 6 weeks ago, the Federal Reserve formally announced its latest plan to get more money out into the economy. The technical term is quantitative easing, which rapidly became QE2 in the vernacular, as it was the second time the Fed had gone down that particular road, buying treasuries and other bonds from banks, in this case, $600 billion worth. The basic idea was to fill bank vaults with cash to encourage more lending, and so bring down interest rates to encourage more spending. Never mind that long-term interest rates have actually been going up since then, but a top central banker declared today that the big bond-buying program has been at least modestly successful so far. We asked our senior business correspondent Bob Moon to prove it.
Today's rosy claim was delivered by the head of the St. Louis Fed, James Bullard, in an interview with CNBC. His reasoning, the economy is warming up.
Many people are marking up their forecasts for the current quarter and into 2011, so I think right now, it looks like we'll see a stronger recovery than we anticipated even a little while ago.
But three economists we spoke to today aren't convinced there's a cause-and-effect relationship between the Fed's actions and the accelerating economy.
especially when you realize that most of the growth that you're seeing has been spurred by the consumer.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's. He says the main indication of success would be more lending by banks, but there's been no sign of that so far. Even so, he says it's impossible to know for sure what effect the Fed's bond buying spree is having because it amounts to trying to prove a negative.
You don't know what would have happened if they hadn't done this. And I think generally you have to go with the theory, and the theory says that it should be having some effect.
But is it really necessary? At Federal Financial Analytics, Karen Petrou says the economy might be improving even without the Fed's cash injection. And she cautions there's a risk of future inflation if the Fed isn't careful with its spending plan.
It has to be judged not only by what it does while we're in it, but what happens as we get out of it. The degree to which the Fed judges the market just right. That's why this is really risky. The Fed has to be perfect, and almost nobody ever is.
At Naroff Economic Advisors, Joel Naroff says the Fed's course was probably prudent.
I think the Fed's action was more to be able to say that if anything goes wrong, they did everything in their power to prevent it from going wrong.
Naroff says the benefits may be small, but as something of an economic insurance policy, the cost has been relatively small as well. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tomorrow's going to be a very big day for telecommunications geeks. Could also be a big day for the rest of us, though, and for how we use the Internet. The Federal Communications Commission is scheduled to vote on what you might fairly call the rules of the road for the web. The board could stop Internet service providers from blocking some sites or shifting them to slower connections. But it could also mean paying more to stream your favorite TV show online. From New York, Marketplace's Janet Babin explains.
The FCC will likely decide that the online space stays a meritocracy, a place where small internet websites are just as fast and accessible as the bigger established ones. Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School.
So the best sites win. YouTube is successful because people like it rather than Google made a good deal with Verizon or AT&T or something.
Some high-speed internet providers want to block or slow information online or charge websites for a fast lane so consumers would get to the websites more quickly. That worries new internet startups and the companies that invest in them. John Borthwick is CEO of BetaWorks. His company was an early financial backer of the internet sites Twitter and Groupon.
It hurts innovation in general, and I think that a tremendous amount of the innovation that we've seen on the internet is driven by the presumption that the platform is free and open for people to build on.
Right now, most consumers pay fees to access the internet, but it's free to website providers. Those providers fear that could change. Like a lot of federal regulations, the internet traffic debate has devolved into a political push and pull. A few key Republican senators have promised to block any FCC action. Communications attorney Robert Reaney says some Republican lawmakers think the rules are unnecessary.
The strange part about Washington, D.C. sometimes is that people get worked up about things that are just theoretical. Largely, there is no problem to solve at this moment.
But some Republicans do advocate that internet service providers should be able to manage traffic over their networks as they see fit. And that may include upping charges for accessing some websites. Reuters reported today that the FCC may allow that. Whatever happens, judicial challenges to the FCC rules are expected. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no sign at all of a Santa Claus rally. But hey, it's early yet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal today that's going to hit a lot of television watchers right where they live. That, of course, would be on the family room couch, suffering through commercials that are completely irrelevant. Why have to sit through a pet food ad if you don't have a pet? Or why do you need to know about the newest minivan when it's just you driving around out there? The Journal says DirecTV is working on what will be the biggest attempt to do targeted ads on TV. The company is going to use what it knows about you, which is a lot, to give you ads you might actually want to see. Joseph Turo teaches communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What is this new system? How does DirecTV going to know who's watching and what they want to see ads for?
Essentially, what they're doing is they're using your set-top box and your DVR. The DVR is going to load a certain number of commercials in to be used when necessary. The set-top box is basically going to hold data about you. And when an advertiser purchases the right to use the data, it's going to shoot the commercial from the set-top box, and you're going to watch it.
This might be a fundamental question, but how does DirecTV know what they know about us? I mean, if you look at Facebook, for instance, they know about us because we tell them, and websites can track our clicks. How does DirecTV know?
Right now, the answer is that it's extremely primitive. They are contracting with third-party data providers. So one of the companies they've said they've contracted with is Experian, which is this huge database provider. But the real sophisticated way is to track everything you do through the set-top box. Your cable company can already do that. They know exactly what you're watching. Okay, if you link that with data that they know based upon your household's income and data about the neighborhood in which you live, and then they go out and they buy extra information about you, they have an enormous amount of data that they can bring to bear on the commercials and the programs that they can show you.
It is, though, somehow a little bit creepier because it's on your television and it's coming to you on your living room couch, or is that just me?
No, it's not just you. Advertisers wouldn't like you to use the word creepy.
Well,
creepy
yeah,
is a word people have been using a lot lately. Actually, they would probably say it's more like a direct mail ad in the sense that they know a certain number of things about you. What they're not using yet is the stuff that you watch on TV to decide what to send to you.
Does it work? Do people stay on channels longer when they're getting these targeted ads? Do we know that yet?
There's some evidence that people watch the commercials more and stay on those channels, yes. It may be because it seems so relevant. It may be because it seems so new that, hey, look, I'm getting stuff that seems to be for me. The question is, do we want companies making up ideas about who we are based on data they have about us? And what are the privacy implications of that?
Well, let me ask you, you're the expert. Do we want that from these companies?
At the very least, I think the companies should be telling us what they're doing, what data they're using, and I think we should begin to talk publicly about the question of what does anonymous mean. Right now, they're saying it's anonymous because they use a code to identify who you are rather than your name. But if your whole world is being displayed for you based upon some code that they have that links you to a whole lot of characteristics that you don't know about, then I think it's important for people to know where that's coming from and have some choice about it.
So in theory, our cable television agreement should come with a multi-page privacy statement at the end of it, right?
Absolutely. And that's true with supermarkets. That's true with mobile apps. That's true with the web in the way that we could actually understand it.
This is a little bit zen, but they're kind of watching us watch them, right?
In many ways, you're absolutely right. We have found in research at the Annenberg Public Policy Center that Americans know that they're being tracked, but they really don't understand how the various points behind the screen get connected.
Joseph Turow from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Turow, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure, sir.
We tend to think of business travel as involving airplanes, people in suits jetting off to some conference or another, sometimes in exotic locales, more often not. But what if your job means hours behind the wheel, driving yourself from sales call to sales call? Producer Michael Rayfield takes the title of our series Road Warriors literally today with a woman for whom driving the highways of Los Angeles is part of the job.
I'm Julie Aiken. I'm in pharmaceutical sales. When I'm out on the road for work, I listen to The Longest Road by Morgan Page. We'll go so far as we please. Giddy up and go, man, different place, different time. All the stars are in their prime. It's actually a love song, but the lyrics say you go down the longest road to nowhere. And frankly, that's just very ironic, because when you're stuck in LA traffic, you really feel like you're going nowhere, and you really aren't. What I call sort of a traffic trance that you fall into when you're stuck in traffic in LA, it helps you kind of move past that. And I may strategize for my next call. I might get energized before a meeting or plan my next vacation.
especially when I'm sitting in traffic in L.A. by LAX and there's flights taking off and landing, and I'm just watching them coming and going while I'm sitting there. There's parts of the job that are very freeing. There's other parts of the job that can sometimes be frustrating. But currently now, the job I have is awesome. I love my customers. I love what I do. I just don't like the fact that sometimes it takes me so long to get where I'm trying to go. People need to realize that when you don't have control in your situation and your job, and I think a lot of people feel that way in our economy right now, that having a playlist and having something that's so personal to you can be so motivating and so refreshing and energizing that I think you shouldn't lose sight of that.
The music page on our website has more of Julie's favorites. You can offer up your own picks as well. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, knowing what you're good at.
Our strength as a company isn't in making t-shirts. It's in this global art community.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 13 points today, about a 10%, finished at 11,478. The Nasdaq climbed 6 points, a 0.25%, 2649 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up 3 points, also a 0.25%, finished at 1247. Goldman Sachs rang up a 1.25% gain today. J.P. Morgan Chase put on 0.7%. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup all rose less than 0.5%. American Express slid 3.5%. Today, investors worry the Federal Reserve's new cap on debit card fees means merchants will avoid credit cards. Speaking of which, MasterCard and Visa, with a healthy chunk of the debit card business, each charged up more than 1% today. AT&T disconnected 0.33%, even after announcing a $2 billion purchase of wireless spectrum to boost its 4G network. Qualcomm, the telecom company that sold that spectrum, traded flat on the day. Bonds bumped up. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped slightly to 3.34%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up December 21st. In Washington, the U.S. Census Bureau releases the first set of 2010 census data at the National Press Club. Stick of the dark? Tomorrow is the shortest day of the year. Then the daylight starts sticking around a little bit longer. Happy winter. And Emmy Award-winning former talk show host Phil Donahue turns 75. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of the national economic conversation we've been having the past year or two has been about the labor market and the 8.5 million people who lost their jobs during the recession, and the millions more who kept their jobs but had their hours or their wages cut. There is another chunk of the population facing an uncertain future, people who've already done their time on the job. From Iowa Public Radio, Sarah McCammon reports.
On a recent afternoon in the small town of Monroe, Iowa, retirees Bill and Maureen Miller open the kitchen door and step outside. They want to show me a new wheelchair ramp built on their back porch several months ago.
With the power chair, yeah, he can come out with his hover around, go right down that ramp, right around to the car, and take off. He can drive, he just can't walk. You know, not at a distance. Just watch that snow and ice, Bill.
Maureen is 77 and Bill is 80. Before the ramp, complications from Bill's diabetes were making it hard for him to get around. They live off Social Security and Bill's small pension from a former employer. But with medical costs and property taxes going up, they say money has been getting tight. So earlier this year, the Millers reluctantly decided to ask for help from a local nonprofit agency. It covered the $2,200 cost to build the ramp.
Well, you know, we've always had good jobs. We've always had nice homes, nice cars. We've always lived good. And but now the economy is like it is. It's just depressing, you know, to have to live and have to worry about where your next meal is going to come from. Or it's always a worry.
The Millers aren't unusual. Peggy Wharton Folsom is with the group Aging Resources of Central Iowa. She says she's hearing from more white-collar retirees who've seen retirement funds dwindle or who can't sell their homes.
We're seeing people that have never in their history had to turn anywhere for assistance.
It's a decision seniors across the country are having to make, says Sandy Markwood. She's the CEO of the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging. In a recent survey, roughly 60% of officials with agencies around the U.S. say they're seeing more of what they describe as middle-income seniors needing help.
They feel humiliated. They never thought they'd have to ask for assistance. And they have a sense of failure. You know, quite honestly, these are people who thought they did everything right, who really held on to the American dream of retirement.
Come on, Tiki. Come on, Molly. Hi.
At the Miller House, Maureen opens a bedroom door and is greeted enthusiastically by her two small dogs. She says it was tough having to ask for the money for Bill's ramp, but now she sees it as a means of staying independent.
It's wonderful that he don't have to fret up them steps no more because he can't do it no more, hardly.
I don't think of myself as being that old, you know. I'm 80, but I don't, you know, I feel good.
The Millers say their goal is to stay in their house and out of a nursing home. While they swallowed their pride and accepted money to build the ramp, they hope they never have to ask their kids for help. In Monroe, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
The t-shirt company Threadless has been around for 10 years now. In that time, it has sold about 4 million shirts with what was when it started and still is now a somewhat unconventional business model. It gets outsiders to come up with the designs. Strangers pick the best ones, and then the company sells those winners. It's crowdsourcing at its economic best. Founder and one-time CEO Jake Nickel has a new book out about the first 10 years of Threadless. It's the story of the company and 10 years' worth of great T-shirt designs, which, I ought to say before we start, you can see on our website. It's marketplace.org. Jake, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Where'd the idea for this company come from? You're 20 years old, you're an art student, and all of a sudden you're making T-shirts?
Yeah, I was going to art school, but I was also working a full-time job as a web developer, and I was a member of an art community online. My contribution to the community was that if you put T-shirt designs up on the forum, I would print the best ones.
Explain how it works for those who might not know.
An artist submits a design. It gets scored by our community of about 1.5 million people. And the top scoring designs, we actually print and sell. We pay the artist $2,000 and a $500 gift certificate, and then royalties on reprint fees. And we come out with 6 to 9 new designs every single week. Last year, we paid over $1.5 million out to artists.
So the business term, the nomenclature for this is crowdsourcing, right? You go out and you get these people to submit and then you crowdsource the evaluation. Did that come organically from your start in that online art community?
Yeah, the term crowdsourcing was coined, I believe, in 2004 by a guy named Jeff Howe, who's an editor for Wired magazine. And that was 4 years into us doing business. And we've become kind of the poster child for crowdsourcing. And there's a lot of interesting crowdsourcing companies that have started up very recently. It's become a very popular business model. But really what we were about is just community-based design, like collaborating as artists. And I think what crowdsourcing is kind of turning into is where people are doing work for companies, like designing logos or things that are not so personal. It's more like work that a company needs done that they're outsourcing to a crowd of anonymous people.
That dynamic that you guys had, I mean, you had the typical startup dynamic. If you look at the pictures in this book, it's the big warehouse space with, you know, the foosball table and a gaming chest and all that. I mean, you had that. And now 10 years later, you've got, you know, 100 employees shipping stuff all over the world.
Yeah, and we still do crazy stuff. Like, half our employees are in our warehouse. And just last week, we had a live band play in our warehouse while people were picking orders. We had a DJ, Martin Atkins, come in, who used to be the drummer of Ministry. It's just part of our culture.
There must have been, in the past 10 years, a couple of moments as you felt your way around this startup that you had of, man, if I only knew back then what I know now. I mean, what were the decision points that turned Threadless from this hobby that you had into a thriving, viable business?
I think that actually not knowing anything was more valuable in growing Threadless than knowing something. And I kind of feel like if I did know the way things were supposed to get done, Threadless wouldn't have happened.
Where do you go now? I mean, what's next beyond T-shirts? Or are you happy just doing art and T-shirts?
Well, T-shirts were just such an easy canvas. You know, every small town in America has a T-shirt printer. But now we're starting to do a lot of partnerships where we're realizing that our strength as a company isn't in making T-shirts. It's in this global art community, and we're feeling like we can do so much more than just make T-shirts with all these artists. So looking back at the past year, we've done a lot of partnerships with Griffin. We made iPhone cases. We made flip-flops with Javianas. We made laptop covers with Dell.
Yeah, it could be anything, right? I mean,
yeah, man, I was joking around. I mean, you could design the frosting that goes on donuts at Dunkin' Donuts. It's ridiculous how it could be anything.
But all right, that I think is jumping the shark.
Yeah, that's too much maybe.
Jake Nickel is the founder. He was also the CEO for a long time of Threadless. He's got a new book out about the company's first 10 years. It is called Threadless. And we have got on our website some of those designs. You're going to want to check them out. There's some pretty interesting T-shirts out there. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Jake, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a corollary of sorts to the interview we did about DirecTV and targeted ads. The New York research firm eMarketer says that this year, for the first time, web ad dollars beat out revenue that newspapers got from printed ads, beat it by a bunch, too. Online ads, the ultimate in targeted ads, as you know, netted almost $26 billion in 2010, papers about $3 billion less. And even though newspaper websites do get online ad revenue, that still wasn't enough to make up for an overall decline in their advertising proceeds this year. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow fell 13 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 ticked up 3 points, also 0.25%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up back here next time, maybe we shouldn't take those iPhones away from kids after all.
They just finished a study that found that kids learn tremendously using the Sesame Street characters on iPhone apps.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.